Good evening and welcome to tonight's program with Elin Suleymanov. He's the Consul General of the Republic of Azerbaijan for the Western United States. My name is Cynthia Miashta. I serve as chair of the club's Asia-Pacific Affairs Forum. Any of those of you who are not members of the Commonwealth Club, we'd like to invite you to join. You'll find membership information and our magazines out in the front hall. I would like to tell you about a few upcoming events that our forum has planned. On March 11th, we're going to be hosting Sumbul Ali Karamali. She's an expert in Sharia law, and she's going to tell us what Sharia law is all about, Sharia finance, and the rise of Sharia finance in the world. So I hope you'll join us for that. On March 15th, we're going to welcome Michael Santoro. He's a professor at Rutgers. He's recently written a book called China 2020. We also have coming up later on America's Chinatowns, and we're doing a program on Chinese traditional medicine, Food is Medicine. So you'll look for those in the next issue of the Commonwealth Club magazine. If you're interested in receiving an email reminder of upcoming events, please give me your name and email address. I have a little sign-up sheet out on the front and that the desk out there in the hall. At this time, let me ask you to just double-check that your cell phones are turned off. We do record all of our programs for our archives as well as for possible radio broadcast. At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Elin Suleymanov, again, the Consul General of Azerbaijan for the Western United States. On November 14th, 2005, the President of the Republic of Azerbaijan, Ilham Aliyev, appointed Elin Suleymanov, the Republic of Azerbaijan's first Consul General to Los Angeles, California, and the Western United States. Prior to this appointment and posting, Consul General Suleymanov served as Senior Counselor of the Foreign Relations Department of the Office of the President in Baku, Azerbaijan. He also served as press officer of the Embassy of the Republic of Azerbaijan in Washington, D.C. Before joining the diplomatic service, Consul General Suleymanov worked with United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Azerbaijan and with the Open Media Research Institute in Prague, Czech Republic. A graduate of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, Consul General Suleymanov also holds graduate degrees from the Political Geography Department of the Moscow State University, Russia, and from the University of Toledo, Ohio. Consul General Suleymanov speaks Azerbaijani, English, Russian, and Czech. I assume for tonight you're going to be speaking English. Would you please join me in welcoming Consul General Suleymanov? Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Miashta. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak here. I value the fact that you have other things to do in the evening at 6 p.m., so thank you for spending this evening with us today. I was just read my Miranda rights, and I know that whatever I say can be used against me, so I will try to be very, very careful. I know it's a hot subject today in the discussion, so I signed my release. It's okay. I also will be speaking English, indeed, but if you don't understand it, that's not because you don't understand it. It's because my accent is very thick. So what I'll ask you to do is interrupt me and ask what I meant. That's not because you don't understand it. It's because I don't pronounce it well. I will try to speak as briefly as possible. It's not easy for a diplomat to speak briefly, so I'll try to do it as concise as possible so we have more time for discussion. Because the subjects I want to talk today about are wide and quite widespread, and while it is focused on energy, the energy in our context, in the context of our region, in the context of Eurasian region, has heavy cultural, geopolitical, and political economic implications, so we need to look in the context of what it means. Let me first touch on the fact that of what is the Republic of Azerbaijan. I mean, that's, I think, is an interesting subject by itself. I I have thought about something today, which was a very strange thing. When I came with my colleagues, and my colleague Elman Abdullayev is here, who is a consul at the consulate, when we came here in 2006, the Republic of Azerbaijan, the independent Republic of Azerbaijan, which was established in 1991 after the fall of the Soviet Union, was 15 years old. Today, when we will celebrate our Independence Day this year, it will be 19 years old. So in a way, if you think about that, the story is still unfolding. So when you ask what is the Republic of Azerbaijan, definition can escape you because it's still work in progress. And one of the key things about the Republic of Azerbaijan that it defies stereotypes in every possible way. For instance, I always have fun talking to my colleagues from American Embassy who talk to me about gender issues, because I remind them that the Republic of Azerbaijan in 1918 became the first parliamentary republic in the world with the predominantly Muslim population. And it granted rights for everybody to vote. When everybody, I say everybody, I mean to every citizen of the Republic of Azerbaijan, regardless of their gender, race, and religion in 1919. That's 2 years before the United States of America granted its rights for vote to women. Now, we lag behind the great state of Wyoming, but we do go ahead ahead of the rest of the United States. Actually, some other things which were first in Azerbaijan, which were very interesting too, is the first opera in the Muslim world was written in Azerbaijan. We claim that the first oil boom happened in Azerbaijan. I hope when you put it on the radio, our friends from Pennsylvania would not hear that, because they also claim that distinction. But let's say that we both believe that we began first, and the only competitor to us is the great state of Pennsylvania. But by 1910, Azerbaijan produced Baku, the capital city of Baku, produced about 50% of global energy supply, oil supply, basically. It wasn't that much, but it was 50%. There are many, many interesting things about this oil thing, because, for instance, Noble brothers made their money in Azerbaijan, and they used that money for the Nobel Prize fund, which is now is endowment, which develops. And so every time someone gets a Nobel Prize, I'm about to scream, "What about me? Don't forget where it comes from." But people forget past very fast, so they don't remember that it came from Azerbaijan. Another thing which is also very interesting is that even then provided for very important strategic location for many reasons. One is that because Baku was such a capital of development of industry, in early 1900s, it was also the place where proletariat was extremely well developed. So that's where the communist ideas and Bolshevik ideas were pretty well spread among the international proletarian movement there. So that's why you had people like Beria and Stalin in Azerbaijan, in Baku there at that time. Actually, there is a cell number 8 in a city jail of Baku, which has a distinction. That's the only person who's ever escaped from that jail happened to be Joseph Stalin when it was under Russian imperial rule. I mean, one thing I want to tell you is that if there's one guy you don't want to escape from your jail, it's probably Joseph Stalin. And that's what happened at that point, and then you know what happened afterwards. And then, speaking of this type of guys, there was something very interesting in 1943. I don't know if you noticed, have seen that role. It's actually a real video of a birthday of Adolf Hitler, which is, it's a chronicle. And when you see that, you become very nervous. I get very nervous, because apparently in 1943, during his birthday, his lieutenants brought him a cake, birthday cake, with a map of Eurasia. And they said to him, take what you want. He took a knife and he cut out Baku with a Caspian Sea. I mean, if you live in Baku, that's not a very comfortable thought. It was it had its blessing. It's actually a blessing in disguise, because he wanted Baku so much that he didn't bomb it too much. But the reason he wanted Baku is because part of the reason Soviet Union was able to sustain the tank offensive against the Nazi Germany was because they had light armor for their tanks, but also because they had abundant supply of gasoline, because Azerbaijani oil, Azeri crude, is very light, so it's easy to refine, and it was very good for the tanks. I hope it's not being used for these purposes anymore, but that is the reality. So this is a very interesting and distinguished past which this place has. It's also a very convoluted past, because if you look at this, when I talked about the First Parliamentary Republic and all that experience, what you would also notice that that experiment lived only for 23 months. It began on May 28, 1918, and on April 28, 1920, it was interrupted by the Bolshevik offensive, invasion, and basically annexation of Azerbaijan to what then became the Soviet Union. But it didn't mean that Azerbaijan ceased to exist, because what many things we think about Soviet Union are not necessarily always true. And that's one of the other stereotypes, because I know people in the West often refer to the Soviets as Russians. We always found it very offensive, because so many people who died, for instance, in World War II fighting Nazi Germany were not Russians. And many of us were in the Soviet Union, not ethnically Russian. So when you look at this, every republic of the former Soviet Union had its own very distinct personality, life, and characteristics, spoke their languages, had their cultures. And in fact, even for me, living in the Soviet Union, going to different republics was a very interesting cultural discovery. In a way, we all have the stereotypes that all American states are the same. Having lived in America for quite some time, I can vouch that there's a great distinction between the state of Idaho, Oklahoma, and the state of California, not to mention the state of Massachusetts. But still, even that is still the same state and the same people in many ways. I mean, you have behavioral distinctions, not really ethnic or language and all this distinction. Now, imagine for a second that you would have, for instance, a state of Massachusetts completely of Chinese ethnic extraction, or a state of New Hampshire of completely, let's say, Mexican extraction. Then it would be a very different story. It would multiply the differences. So that was what happened in the Soviet Union, and the failure to reconcile and to provide a common denominator beyond simple oppression was the reason why the Soviet Union fell apart, because they were not able to provide anything which would unite people of very different cultures. They did in the beginning, because communist ideology was very strong, but just like any ideological regime, the Soviet Union could not survive its own pressures. It was very ideological, and there was a lot of zealotry in the beginning, but then at some point, people wanted to live their lives, and ideology and normal lives don't get along very well. So basically, people began living their lives, ideology weakened, and there was no common denominator. So that was an interesting experience we had. But going back to what happened after the breakup of the Soviet Union, Azerbaijan emerged as one of the 15 republics of independent republics of the former Soviet Union. And we basically pretty much, with some differences, began on the same level with all other republics. We all have shared the common past anyway. What was different is the choices we all made. How do we move forward? And what you see today in distinctions between the republics of the former Soviet Union is not only because we had the common past, but also because we have divergent decisions made in the beginning of our independence. Let me give you a couple of examples. When Azerbaijan emerged in 1991 as an independent state, it was a country torn apart by a number of issues. One of them, which continues to be a major challenge today, and I will touch maybe a bit later on this, it is a conflict with neighboring Armenia, which resulted in Azerbaijani territories being occupied. So we basically have about 16 to 20% of Azerbaijani territory, internationally recognized territory, occupied by Armenian forces as a result of ethnic cleansing, we have about 1 million people displaced. So that is a challenge which already no other republic in the former Soviet Union had at this point, that you emerge with this inherent problem. The other problem is, of course, the economic transition, which hit Azerbaijan very strongly, just as it hit the rest of the Soviet Union. But it was multiplied by the results of the war, because you basically had devastation, and part of your population was grossly non-productive, refugee situation. I mean, it's very difficult. And the third problem is, of course, the internal civil strife, because what those things provide for when you have this military situation is that you have people with guns, you have a certain euphoria of nationalism, so people begin struggling with each other. There is a, politically, it's not a very stable place. So when, in 1993, about a year and a half after the emergence of Azerbaijani state, what happened was the person who came to power was Azerbaijani veteran politician, Heydar Aliyev, who used to be a member of Politburo. And he was a very, very intelligent and very, very wise man. So what he decided was a very interesting thing. He understood that to move forward, Azerbaijan needs to open up. He made several decisions which were crucial for the future of Azerbaijan. One is that we need to open up and build ties with the outside world. The second decision, which I think is fundamental to understand Azerbaijan, is that Azerbaijan cannot exist by itself. We need the region to succeed, because if the region doesn't succeed, our success will be limited, even if we have that. And not to mention that having a success in a region which is not successful is also difficult. So the greatest value at that point in the Caspian was the Caspian energy resources. But why would you invest large amounts of sums of money into a country which was at just emerged 2.5 years ago, has had certain instability and basically had a war with a neighbor? How do you do that? Moreover, Baku, Azerbaijan doesn't have the largest reserves of oil. We have significant and very significant reserves of oil, but Russia has bigger reserves of oil. Kazakhstan may have bigger reserves, I don't know. And Turkmenistan claims to have greater reserves of gas, although no one knows because it's difficult to check. But in any case, why would you invest in Baku, in Azerbaijan? And the reason was because of the steps taken by the government of Azerbaijan. Heydar Aliyev suggested to the Western companies that we come up with a practice which we have pioneered and has not been replicated yet anywhere in the former Soviet Union, which is a legislative guarantee for PSAs, production sharing agreements. So any company which comes in the energy sector, comes to Azerbaijan, signs an agreement with Azerbaijani side, that agreement, that contract, production sharing agreement, goes into the parliament and is ratified by the parliament as a law of the land. Our Western partners wanted that because they wanted to have predictability and sanctity of contract in a place which has no tradition of that. We agreed to that because we wanted to have a long-term commitment from our partners to the country. Well, I have to tell you this. First, they were very happy about this, our partners. Now they're less happy about this because initially that meant that we have to fulfill all our obligations. Now that means that they have to fulfill their obligations, and they're not always that happy about this kind of things. But at least it makes life predictable. And one thing which happened was that, imagine, in 1994, on September 20, we signed something with the Western companies, which is called Contract of the Century. It was then called Contract of the Century. It was $8 billion of direct investment in the Azerbaijani energy sector, and specifically in Azeri-Chiragunashli offshore oil field. Now, at that time, it was the single largest investment in the former Soviet Union. Again, not in Russia, not in Ukraine, not in Kazakhstan, which are all bigger nations, in Baku, Azerbaijan. Precisely because of the steps taken by the government, not because we had, again, had bigger... It's not the resources, it's how you use your resources. 16 years since then, we signed a contract for 30 years. 16 years and counting, the Republic of Azerbaijan fulfills its obligations faithfully under that agreement, and so do our partners. Now, think about this. Today, we would never sign an agreement like this. Because Azerbaijan is stronger, the oil price is no longer $18 per barrel. Things have changed. The contract signed today is radically different from this contract signed then. But that's not about money alone. It's about being a reliable partner. And Azerbaijan has been reliable in that. And we take a lot of pride in making sure that we will fulfill the obligations under this contract to the end. That's a very important part of, because that basically is a game changer in the region. And if you notice that, doesn't happen that often. We often have other contracts with other partners in which we are not leading part, in which they change the conditions way too often. As a result of that project, Azerbaijan and its partners have built something which is of great strategic importance, and that's a pipeline, oil pipeline, which originates in Baku, Azerbaijan, goes to Georgia, Tbilisi, and ends up in a Turkish Mediterranean port of Ceyhan, and that's a Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline. I was quite strongly championed by the Clinton administration. It was completed under the Bush administration. Very interesting project, because what it does, it provides a non-OPEC supply of friendly transit nations, oil transiting to friendly nations, and terminating in an open seaport in a NATO allied country of Turkey. I mean, think about that. If you sit in the middle of the night and say, what kind of oil pipeline I would want to have? This is your dream pipe. I mean, really. I mean, this is what you want to have. No? I mean, what else? What else can you come up with? Realistically speaking. Yet there were people who didn't want that for their own reasons and all this. Now everyone wants it. It supplies about even 5% of Israel's oil supply or something like this. Quite significant chunk. But important part of it is that, realistically speaking, when we talk about energy security, we are not talking only about moving away from certain fuels, because this is really not that realistic. I live in Los Angeles now. I haven't seen people moving in herds to use public transportation. They all come up to a meeting to discuss energy efficiency, and then they go and drive their cars. It happens every day. I watched it. And so in a way, what you do, you need to diversify supplies and transit routes. And that is what this pipeline provides. But it doesn't substitute anybody. I don't want to mislead anybody to believe that, look, that tomorrow Caspian becomes next Persian Gulf or something. It's not that. It's that it provides a crucial element of added security by diversification. Diversification is what you want to have. And today, together with our partners, we work on trying to bring diversification in European natural gas markets. So we're working on a number of projects. Most of them go to Georgia, our partner in the region, to another partner nation of Turkey, and then to them to Europe. For instance, there's a TGI, it's a Turkey-Greece interconnector, so we provide for the first time natural gas to European Union, to Turkey, to Greece, and some other possibilities. Now we're discussing the Nabucco pipeline, which would provide an added element of security, again, to European markets, which are increasingly dominated by single producer. Now, oil is a bit different from gas. In terms of gas, you need to have a devoted consumer and all this. I mean, you need to know what you're doing. In oil, it's kind of easy. You put it on a tanker, and then you could sell it. Now, why this matters is because it's difficult to disagree with Steve Pickens that the next major fuel probably will be natural gas. We are talking about alternative energy and all this. That's understandable. But to move towards that, you need an interim cleaner fuel, and natural gas is immensely more clean than oil, so everyone knows it. The problem is that Europeans who talk a lot about energy security do not want to take leadership in providing that energy security, as a matter of fact. So Azerbaijan has done its share in trying to invest in its production, in upstream operations, but we're not going to build the European energy infrastructure for them. They need to decide. At the end of the day, Azerbaijan is able and does sell gas to Russia on its border on a very good market price, and sells to Iran, sells to Turkey, sells to Georgia. I mean, it's not us who needs it. We do need it in a way because we want to have diversified consumption of our natural gas, but it's not an issue of vital importance for us to whom we sell. But it is an issue, we believe, of vital importance for Europeans from whom they buy, at least in terms of diversity. We would try to diversify that. So it's an interesting thing to see. In general, however, all of this project constitutes something which is called the New Silk Road or the East-West Transportation Corridor. And it's not limited to energy alone. Energy provides a very good backbone for this. Now, don't forget that the European Union was built initially as a coal union. What people often forget that at the beginning of that was a union was based on energy. Energy is always a backbone of any development. But it adds on other things. Today we're talking about Trans-Eurasian Information Highway, and Azerbaijan has, for instance, actively promoted a resolution at the United Nations supporting that project, which would provide for fiber optic communications and all this between Europe and Asia, passing through Caucasus and Central Asia, and namely to Azerbaijan. We're actively engaged with a railway project, which is a Karsa-Halkalaki-Baku, which begins in Turkey, goes to Georgia and terminates in Baku, and then to Baku by ferry connects to Central Asian network. So ostensibly you could put your luggage in London and pick it up in Shanghai without ever bypassing territories you don't want to bypass. The question there is, I would say you probably could take that train. I don't know why you want to do that. It's easier to fly. But you could want to send something. And this is that's a very interesting interconnector as well. So we're talking about a new changing region. However, we should not forget that these ideas of East-West Corridor and East-West Interconnectors and Silk Road were promoted under Clinton administration in a way, under Bush administration, when there was a vision and leadership of the United States. At this point, the United States, I would think, needs to look at the opportunities which Central Asia and Caucasus provide. Because at this point, yes, there's I know that the United States is looking at its priorities and looking at what it's going to do and how to address the situation in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And by the way, our soldiers served in Iraq and as a part of international coalition and still serve in Afghanistan. But what makes me uncomfortable is that we only think about things which are crises. It's, you know, you almost have to create a crisis to get any attention from Americans. I mean, you need to blow something up, you need to create a major situation, and then they say, oh, yeah, you know, we'll give you $5,000 to fix it. That's not a solution. We need to work with people, we need to work with partners in order to make provide for situations which do not result in crisis. And that takes a little bit of a longer-term strategic view. And it takes moving away from symbolism. Symbolism is important, and I'll touch on this, why I think it's important. But it is important that we look at the real issues and understand that in our region, most nations are driven by national interest, not by ideology. And that's a very interesting thing. We categorize people by ideological perceptions. But in reality, most nations do act based on their national interest, simply and very simply so. And in order to do that, we need to address and understand those national interests. For instance, one of the key priorities for Azerbaijan today, and probably the key priority, is to resolve its long-standing conflict with Armenia. There are numerous international documents, including the UN Security Council resolutions, UN General Assembly resolutions calling for withdrawal of Armenian troops and bringing the two nations together. It hasn't happened yet. Instead, for instance, in our part of the world, the United States has tried to focus on symbolism, which is great. I mean, I like symbolism. So when they bring together an Armenian and Turkish foreign minister and they shake hands, that's great. That is fine. That's a good thing. The problem with that is that is irrelevant in the current context. They're talking about history of 100 years old, But the elephant in the room is clearly the situation currently on the ground. It's not about shaking hands in front of the camera. It's about getting things done. And the future of the very same Armenia depends very much on its integration in the region. And it could only be integrated as a result of solving the problem with Azerbaijan trying to resettle the conflict on the basis of international law. No smiles, no flashes can help that if we don't talk about the reality. And that is something we often forget. And for politicians, it's easy to talk about high matters. But in reality, we need to address things which are pressing. Same things with energy issues. We could talk a lot about alternative energy and all this. But the reality is that today we need to get to build that pipeline as soon as possible. And no matter of discussions and all that would help if we don't address the simple issue, who's going to pay and who's going to take the leadership on that matter. Those are things which are important. And let me tell you why those are important. About 1.5 years ago, the country which was darling of everybody in the West, called my very good friend and neighbor Georgia, was doing pretty well. It was our American friends who actually forgot that now, used to call it a beacon of democracy, the excellent example and all this. But look what happened. Because the actual problem of territorial conflicts within Georgia was not addressed, today no one talks about social development or democracy in Georgia. It becomes almost irrelevant because we did not address the real issue, because we all like the flashpoints and serial, shaking hands and symbolism. That's good, but we need to address the real problems. And Georgia learned it in the hard way, unfortunately. We all liked the... Look, 5 years ago, we witnessed something in Ukraine which was called Color Revolution. Everyone talked how great it was and all this. But the candidate who was defeated, and cheerfully so, and cheered for being basically defeated by the West, Mr. Yanukovych is back as the president of Ukraine. Why? Because, again, we looked at the symbolism. We like the stereotype. We like the excitement. But we don't want to do the real thing. But the reality is that people of Ukraine have things and needs, and they need to be addressed. That's as simple as that. So when we look at this, I think one of the things which our American friends can do is to look for strengthening their friendship with existing partners in the region. And Azerbaijan is one of those partners. Another thing, for instance, speaking of symbolism, as I speak here today, Israel's foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, is in Azerbaijan. That's quite, for me, it's quite an event. He comes to Azerbaijan, talks about real issues and real challenges our two nations have. Now, why I bring that up? Because Azerbaijan, if someone asks me, and believe me, I get this question asked sometimes, why do you deal with these guys? And my answer would be, why wouldn't I deal with these guys? The fact that he is Jewish or not is irrelevant because we need that relationship. Because pragmatically speaking, we benefit from it, and so do the Israelis. It's a mutually beneficial relationship. Same as our relationship with Georgia, same as our relationship with Turkey, same as our relationship with other nations. We don't need to bring the ideological impact into this. And I applaud for the government of Azerbaijan and the government of Israel for being able to move beyond these things and basically look into the pragmatic prosperity of their two nations and two respective peoples. One other thing which is also important is that an element of symbolism, I just discredited symbolism, but symbolism actually has an element which plays here. Building a relationship with friendly Muslim nations, predominantly Muslim nations, for the United States and Israel is important because it does provide an example when a Muslim nation and Israel and Muslim nation and the United States of America can work together constructively on the basis of mutual national interest. Azerbaijan is not alone in this, of course. The other millions of other nations, most obviously Turkey, but also, for instance, nations of Central Asia, which is an untapped pool of goodwill and friendship towards the West. We don't need to wait for a crisis to be friends with these people. What they need is not bombing, not soldiers, just normal relationship with respect to their interests, with understanding of who they are, and with appreciation of people who lead those countries towards a path of normalcy. So while I have certain concerns about how focused our relationships has been, I am also very hopeful, because what I can see is that there is an enormous potential to both for the United States and our part of the world, and for Azerbaijan as it gets stronger in our region and assumes a greater leading role. We just need to get our priorities straight and refocus on our relationship, and I think there is a great potential there. Now, I know I have spoken for way too long, and it's evening, and I know I had coffee. I'm not sure all of you had that, so I will be happy to answer your questions. Who moderates you? Yeah. Yes.
I'd be interested to hear what you think when you look at what happened with Georgia and what happened with the Ukraine. Is that, when you look at it, is it symbolism? Is it something that doesn't affect you, or are you nervous in relation to your energy situation?
Stability in Georgia is, and prosperity of Georgia is fundamentally important for Azerbaijan. And part of it is because, as we discussed, is because we're part of the region. We don't exist in seclusion from it. One example is, for instance, today, the state oil company of Azerbaijan is the largest taxpayer in Georgia. So you can imagine that we're contributing to the economy a lot. So for us, it's important. What happened in Georgia is in terms of the military conflict in August of 2008 is a very unfortunate situation. Both we would be very encouraged to see both Russia and Georgia come to terms and build friendly relationship, because both Russia and Georgia are going to be there for forever. None is moving out. As President of Azerbaijan Ilham Aliyev said, very eloquently, I think, he said, look, both Russia and Georgia are our friends, and we want our friends to be friends with each other. I mean, that's easier said than done, of course, but we do hope and we will contribute to trying to bring these two nations together. And again, what happened in Ukraine, though, is a choice of Ukrainian people. It was not enforced. It's their choice. What I think is important for all of us to understand is that we often fall into this euphoria of, oh, these things go great. This is exactly follows the stereotype I had. We have to be a bit careful with this. And we should appreciate not only friends who always say, yes, sir, or yes, ma'am, to whatever we ask them, but the friends who have their own interests and who are able to have a frank discussion and sometimes say no to things which are not in their national interest. So what happened for us in our case, in the both examples in Georgia and Ukraine, have reinforced two of Azerbaijani trademark elements of our politics. One is pragmatism. You have to be pragmatic, and you know where you exist and which region you live in, and to build your relationship with neighbors on a fully pragmatic and rational manner. And the second is, of course, the beauty of evolutionary development. We need to develop step by step, incrementally, to understand, to move society forward. Revolutionary changes usually shake up society's way too unfortunate. Revolution is not a sign of anything good. It's basically a sign of things gone horribly wrong. So we were hoping that evolutionary development is a good thing. Oh, well, that happens when you depend on one source. And that's the whole point of Azerbaijani politics, not to depend on one source. And, in fact, increasingly not to depend on one transit. And again, this is an interesting situation because there's probably no one closer in the world to each other than Azeris and Turks. If you look at Azerbaijani and Turkish society, they're the closest people to each other. Yet, when you fully depend on one transit, even if it's your closest fraternal nation, you would feel that dependence. So the more alternatives you have, the better it is. Always. For everybody.
Good evening, Consul.
Yes, sir.
You recommended that Americans get beyond just the symbolism. What are some specific tasks you would like to see America do that could increase security for Azerbaijan and the region? And what are some specific actions you would really not like to see America do in the region?
I can speak only in terms of Azerbaijan at this point. Two specific actions which come right to my mind. The first is to take a stronger principled approach on the trying to bring Azerbaijan and Armenia closer on the resolution of the Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict. The things on the ground are pretty obvious. So for the United States actually has spelled out what it should do. It just hasn't focused enough on that. So that is something. And when I talked about this earlier, is that we don't need for a crisis to erupt. I mean, there are people with guns on both sides. It was quite a heavy military operation until 1994. So we don't need that war to erupt again to say, oh, we should have done something. We're saying, obviously, let's do something now. And Americans can do something. Americans can show leadership. They're able of that. And when Americans show leadership, they have a stellar reputation of getting things done. So America should probably live up to its own reputation. And they can do that. It's not that difficult. One example, very simple example. My American friends always talk about how important the relationship between Azerbaijan and America is, yet they have forgotten to appoint an ambassador to Azerbaijan for some time now. It's as simple as that. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't want to offend my good friends at the State Department, but I mean, the omission is very obvious. The other thing is, for instance, to show more leadership on energy issues. Very often on global matters, when the United States does not show leadership, things usually take time to happen. Under Clinton administration and under early Bush administration, Americans have been very committed and shown an enormous commitment and actually brought about a major success and change in the region. They could do that now with the natural gas issues. So that is something, the two issues which they can do. On the many, many things we don't want Americans to do, I don't even want it to begin because I don't want to give anybody any wrong ideas. But let me just say that whatever we do, we need to think about long-term consequences for the region. And any increase in tension actually provides for the long-term damage, so we need to be careful with this.
My Russian grandfather, Nikolai Ivanovich Krasinovsky, was sent in 1876 to establish your legal system. And I was pleased to hear, but that did take root. Do you recognize or have a way of resolving the claims? Because he did own some real estate there, and I don't know what the status of that might be.
Well, so it's his fault that Stalin escaped from jail. Now I know. It's an interesting question. But what happened in Azerbaijan is we talked about the turbulent history. Imagine there was a Persian Empire with its real estate claims all on my territory. Then there was a Russian Empire with its imposed territorial claims. Then there was independent Azerbaijan. Then there was a Russian invasion. Then there was a Soviet Union with its own nationalization process. And now there was a Republic of Azerbaijan. If we even try to open that Pandora's box, I don't think where we end up. So in our case, I don't think that's a big issue. I don't think it's a big issue, but Azerbaijan, I think, but just a small caveat on this. We talked a lot about energy. One of the big successes in Azerbaijan was a land privatization. What they have done soon after the independence, they privatized land, so people were able to grow their crops and have their animals, farm animals. As a result, Azerbaijan became very self-sufficient in terms of meat and milk production, which is very important because we used to import that. That's an important thing when you let people have things. It's good, and second, it's also good because we should not forget that outside the capital city of Baku, Azerbaijan is predominantly agricultural society. So in a way, while most people know about Azerbaijan's oil and gas, some of our neighbors, including those in Moscow, really value our early cucumbers, fully organic, by the way, no genetic modifications, and not that expensive. So if you really want to have good cucumbers and tomatoes, you don't have to go to Whole Foods. No offense there, I do buy in Whole Foods, but we do put quite a good competition to that.
Mr. Consul, could you give us a little bit of a picture, perhaps a little bit historically, but more today, of the relationship between your country and Iran, and perhaps address the issue of whether the Azerbaijan could help improve, act as a mediator or improve relations between Iran and the United States and perhaps lead to a more effective working relationship between our country and Iran?
Azerbaijan has two major neighbors. To the north, it's the Russian Federation, which is about 15 times bigger than Azerbaijan, and the Republic of Iran to the south, which is about 10 times bigger than Azerbaijan. We have had, culturally, we're very close. As you know, a significant number of Azeris, ethnic Azeris, live in Iran. In fact, I think it's about, estimates vary, it's from 18 to some several, even upwards from 18 million people who have Azerbaijani ethnic background. So Azeri is spoken throughout Iran. It's a culture very, very similar, music, I mean, religion-wise. There are deep ties between the people, the families on both sides of the river. And when I say river, it's Araxes River. And the reason there are two sides of the river is because in 1828, what today is the Republic of Azerbaijan was occupied by the Russian Empire and basically divided between Russia and Persian Empire at that time, and whatever was to the south of the river remained with Iran. Whatever was to the north became part of the Russian Empire, then became independent Azerbaijan. So the relationship is on a cultural level, is very strong. We have certain differences in how we see how the government and a society should be built. Azerbaijan is a staunchly secular state. Its society is built exclusively on a civic identity based on the constitution. It's not a religious society. We respect the right of Iran to build whatever society they want, but we do want to have our right to choose our own options and not to depend on any of our neighbors. Now, a relationship with Iran has not always been easy. At times, we know that our Iranian friends have been somewhat partial towards our Armenian neighbors, even at the most difficult times of Azerbaijan's war with Armenia. I think the relation is normalizing, and we're having quite interesting dialogue. This year we tried to sell some gas to Iran, and it goes back and forth. It's actually not too bad. The question is that we want to build a region, again, which is stable. Iran is a serious and inescapable presence in our part of the world. It's a very serious and strong presence. I mean, there's no way you can escape that. So we need to build normal relations with our neighbors. And Azerbaijan has a view of building, you know, if you don't have any irreconcilable differences, why not to build good relations? In terms of Iran's relation with the West, it's a difficult question. First of all, I'm not sure we're strong enough to be mediators. Second, Iranians and the West talk to each other quite a lot although we can't always figure out what are they talking about. I really don't fully know what the Iranian side wants from the West and what West wants from the Iranian side. It's very difficult it all reminds me of a divorced couple sending each other cease and desist messages from, and I don't want to be that intermediary which delivers those messages back and forth. So I'm not really sure what are the end results. I think what we need to do is to find a way to accommodate in a way legitimate national interests of Iran without undermining regional security and without undermining the non-proliferation regime. How to do that? I think I will not claim any part of the Nobel Prize money for the guy who gets that for figuring that out. To be honest, that is something which deserves a great recognition if someone comes up with a solution. I hope I answered your question. I haven't confused you even more. Yes, sir.
Azerbaijan's economy is obviously characterized in large part by its oil production. But my question is, and I guess some cucumbers as well.
Tomatoes too.
And produce in general. My question is, what other parts of Azerbaijan's economy draw attention from foreign investors?
In fact, let me say this. By the end of the former Soviet Union's existence, Azerbaijan was not known for so much for oil production, but for oil machinery. So, for instance, most of the Soviet oil rigs and pumps and all that were produced in Azerbaijan. So that's an important part of it. So we need to remember this because Azerbaijan has moved towards then already, as late as then, moved towards industry and also towards petrochemicals, and which were kind of polluting the Soviet petrochemical complex was polluted. And also towards, for instance, things like Baku had the only air conditioning plant in the entire former Soviet Union, which is indicative, right? So we do have skilled labor and all that in Azerbaijan. What the government has come up with is a regional development program, by regional development we refer to the regions of Azerbaijan. Because we have to, as I mentioned, outside Baku, the capital, Baku and the peninsula of Apsheron, which goes into the Caspian Sea, most of the country produces agriculture and non-energy related products. So what we're trying to do is to invest the oil money into non-energy sector. So they're giving tax breaks, preferential treatment, they're building factories outside Baku in the region, so basically to keep things going outside. So far, it has worked in a way. I mean, it hasn't worked the way we would like it to work, but it has produced some result. Part of what we do is try to build infrastructure. I mean, highways and bridges are a very visible presence in Azerbaijan today. And they are done through something called the Oil Fund of Azerbaijan. State Oil Fund in Azerbaijan has basically been a sovereign fund for investment into projects of significance for the future of the country. As recent as now, as I think yesterday, the president of Azerbaijan just signed a decree sponsoring Azerbaijani PhD students in Europe. So there's investments like that. One thing I want to, and by the way, the State Oil Fund in 2007 won the UN, was the first ever organization from East and Central Europe to win the UN Prize for Transparency in Public Sector, which is quite impressive from the United Nations, not from Azerbaijan. But most importantly, what we're trying to do is to partner with our Western partners, and not only Western, other partners as well, international partners, to co-invest in our technology, in our development outside Baku. One sector on which I think we've been very much involved here, and Jason knows this, here in California, has been a development of the new technologies and communication sector. That's actually one of the greatest tax contributors to the state budget. New technology economy grew very fast. Of course, as you said, Azerbaijani economy is mostly driven by the energy sector. But you cannot explain the fastest growing economy in the world in 2008, about 36% GDP growth, and actually 9%, 9 to 11% GDP growth in 2009, where the whole world was going into a crisis, all simply by oil and gas. It was construction, it was infrastructure development, it was technology, it was communications, it was all those sectors. Now, one important part of it is that Azerbaijan doesn't only look at being a producer nation. We are an energy producer, but what we're also trying to do is to become an energy hub and transportation hub for the region. And increasingly that is becoming the truth. Infrastructure in Baku, for instance, now we're talking about new seaport on the Caspian Sea. Baku is the largest port on the Caspian Sea. Trying building links to Central Asia, between Asia and Central Asia. Caucasus and Central Asia, I'm sorry. Railway communications and all the things. So we're looking into developing country in general. One interesting thing which happened, and you mentioned FDI, foreign direct investments. Of course, they're concentrated in the sectors like communications and energy. That's natural. However, what you do have now is a significant increase in domestic investment. So very often, if you, for instance, invest into something which is medium-sized enterprise, for instance, or clothing line, or you invest into agriculture production, you don't really need an outside foreign investment. You could do it yourself. I mean, we do have liquidity in the country. So increasingly, you see people investing themselves into this. A major subject of Avigdor Lieberman's discussions in Baku, the foreign minister of Israel, now I just read it today, was that he looked at new technologies, even desalinization plants in Azerbaijan, and also new agriculture developments, education exchanges, and all the things, which I think is a good opportunity for all of us.
Thank you for coming and speaking to us tonight.
Thank you, sir.
We have a lot of interest in the U.S. and what's going on in the Russian Federation, and I imagine you, too, have interest in that. Recent military buildup, activities in Chechnya, of course, in Georgia, 2008. I'm just hoping to get your perspective on your relationship with Russia and where things might be going there.
There is no question that Russia has become much more assertive and much more present in the region than it had been. It's no longer a junior partner to anybody in the region. Russia feels that it has interests in the region and and they have to be protected at any cost. And they don't hesitate to emphasize that at any cost. And we've seen that. When Russia feels that it's threatened, its interests are threatened, be it in Georgia, be it inside the Russian Federation, such as was the case in Chechnya, it could use force, and sometimes perhaps even excessive force. We, from the very beginning, have said to our Russian friends that we're neighbors. We're not going away, you're not going away. Russia, simply by being such a large nation and being a partner nation, has very legitimate interests in the region, and they have to be respected. Yet, we too have legitimate interests, and we have deadlines. National interests and sovereignty of Azerbaijan are not negotiable. They are not negotiable. Our autonomy of our decision-making, based exclusively on our perceptions of what is in national interest, is not negotiable. We could partner with Russians sometimes when we feel that it's in our interest. We may not. We may disagree with Russia. For instance, there's a clear disagreement over the status of the territories within Georgia. Azerbaijan fully supports the territorial integrity of Georgia. Those are Georgian territories. They should be under Georgian control. There's no question there for us. Russia feels otherwise. Okay, but let us disagree on that. There are some things in which we strongly agree with the Russian Federation. For instance, we also believe that Kosovo should not be independent. Russians agree. In fact, Georgians, Russians, and us, we all agree on this. This is an interesting case. But in general, as long as we respect each other's sovereignty and treat each other as equal partners, Russia will succeed, and we will succeed. The moment we begin telling people and lecturing them what to do, we won't succeed. So we try to refrain from that in terms of Russia, but we also hope that Russians will refrain from that as it concerns us. Now, Azerbaijan has always acted in terms of balanced foreign policy and all this. We've never taken any particular sides. And we are not going to take particular sides. But to have a balanced ability to maneuver and have balance, you need to have some balance of presence. So that's why we welcome a diverse presences in our part of the world. The more diverse the presences are, the more constructive will be the environment. Thank you.
Mr. Consul General, as you know that there are usually issues associated with IP. Of course, in different countries, that means different. And leaving the FDI out of energy sector, would you touch upon how Azerbaijani government or the legal system supports the IP issues if there are FDI directly?
IP issues?
Intellectual property.
Oh, international property, yeah. Okay. Well, international property is, I will fully respect private property. I mean, there's no question there. I mean, its property rights are guaranteed by the Constitution. So whoever, I mean, if you buy something, you buy something. You could fully own the company in Azerbaijan if you're a foreigner. That's fine, and it belongs to you. And it cannot be alienated other than through the legal means. So, I mean, that's not even a question there. I haven't seen complaints on that basis.
I want to thank you for mentioning that the state of Wyoming was the first to give women the right to vote because it's my home state.
Yeah, good, good. It's a beautiful state, too.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
But I was wondering if you could comment on the role of women in Azerbaijan today.
The reason I'm laughing is because both of my grandmothers were medical doctors. My mother is a professor of nanotechnology and doctor of science, and I am quite used to presence of strong women in my life. So, usually, one of the good elements of the Soviet, perhaps, legacy is that they provided for an ability for women and men to develop equally in a society. That was good. Now, I think there's always the need to move forward with this. I don't think I wish to have more women involved in political and social life. That's important. But we have very outspoken leaders among ladies on a ministerial level, ambassadorial level, on members of parliament are ladies. So it's, I mean, the chair lady of the Human Rights Commission in the parliament is a woman. So you have all this. I would want to specially emphasize something, which I actually wrote that in an op-ed. I don't know if it came out in Wyoming. There was one which came out in Wyoming too, Eagle Tribune. Yes, yes. Is the role which it all comes down to personal example. It matters a lot. So the role, for instance, the First Lady of Azerbaijan plays today is very important. Let me just give you a little bit of an overview. She's not only a member of parliament, but she's also a goodwill ambassador for both UNESCO and, more importantly, the first female goodwill ambassador for the ISESCO, which is the Islamic equivalent of UNESCO. And she's a very active lady. She actually hosted a conference in 2008, I believe, on women leadership in the Muslim world, where it brought together women from all over the Muslim world and from the outside. I mean, we helped to arrange, facilitate a delegation from California, in where women sat down and talked to each other. I mean, it was sometimes quite a heated discussion, but it's an opportunity for women to talk to each other. And one of the things which were noticeable, that there were disagreements between how women see their status. Some women in the West were absolutely happily convinced that they have much more freedom than some other women. And some other women from the East said, oh, you have no freedom, I am free, you are not. And it was an interesting discussion. But it's not a surprise that it happened in Azerbaijan, because that's what Azerbaijan does, brings people together. And I'm in a way grateful to our First Lady for being able to do that. Now, when I said about the personal example, I think the more people like her we have, where people look up to and want to become like them, is something which would probably increase. And you could see already that in my education among girls and all this, that takes a lot of place, and the leadership among younger ladies. And one example, which is also very important, and I think its underlying importance of this issue should not be underestimated. The First Lady is not just only a political figure, she is also a professional eye doctor. So which is an important factor. You have to have a professional background to achieve something. This is, I think, an important part. And that's an achievement of the Soviet Union in a way, because it allowed so many people in our part of the world, be it men or women, to have professional background which they could build upon in the future.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Consul General, for being here tonight and for sharing your insight and for such an informative talk.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all for joining us as well.
I think I dropped your pen.
And this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is now adjourned. Thank you.